Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Enhancing human performance has been part of the human condition since the beginning of time. Romans who ran the marathon were running barefoot for a while, and then they discovered shoes could help them run a little bit faster.
For years, athletes have been asked to give everything to their sport.
It's time to start asking, what do people want from sports at a very basic level?
Are steroids good or bad? That's the question.
Gene therapy is absolutely where things will move.
You can get the muscle to grow by 50% in 2 weeks.
Neuroscience will allow people to break through physical barriers.
Three in a row, way to go.
If we're not trying to be better, we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing?
We're sort of evolving into two classes of human being: enhanced human beings and unenhanced human beings.
Who knows what the potential of a human is? And so why not find out?
That's a trailer for the new docuseries on ESPN Plus. Enhanced is the name of the docuseries. 6 parts to it. ESPN bringing Enhanced to look at the modern world of sports training, technology. Alex Gibney is the executive director. ESPN Plus, if you haven't heard about it, is a $5 per month internet streaming service, obviously from the ESPN family. 2 of the episodes directed by Emmy Award winning Paul Tabliib, who joins us on the line now. Evening, Paul.
Hello, nice to have you. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, great to have you with us. So, who dreamt up Enhanced? I mentioned Alex Gibney, who people are familiar with. He's the executive producer. We all know about the ESPN 30 for 30s on this side of the pond. Rest assured, everybody listening has seen them. When did Enhanced come about?
Well, about a year ago, I heard from Gibney's office, and I was very thrilled to hear that from him, given a guy who's won Academy Awards, Emmy Awards, Peabody Awards, and to work with his operation to tell these stories. For me personally, as a director and a producer, was fantastic. I've actually done a 30 for 30 myself as well. So very excited to work with Gibney. And they said, we want to find a way to tell these different stories, each different chapter, 6 different stories about the world of sports. And I was fortunate enough to direct 2 of the episodes.
You took on episode 3, which is Mind Gurus, and episode 5, yep, which is Endurance. I watched both of them this morning. So, I mean, we could give people a flavor. I guess they have to check them out themselves is the point. How is ESPN Plus doing as a matter of interest?
No, that's a good question. All I can say, because the answer is I don't know, but I do know that when things are really, really good, you hear lots of things about it, and I haven't heard anything. So I think, I think a cable network launching an OTT network, when you're used to ESPN being a free cable channel, entering to a very different world. My gut feeling is they have a challenge ahead of them, but the answer is I actually have no information whatsoever.
I guess it's such a saturated market, and not least in the era of piracy, we can all watch the good stuff anyway.
Exactly. But what they've done is they've tried to create a premium channel, like all the 30 for 30s are there, as well as Enhanced. And they also have a lot of, the other thing is, live sports draws a lot of attention. It's the one sort of thing that breaks the mold in the world of cable and people cord cutting. And they have lots of, I wouldn't say esoteric, but, regional or specialized live events that some people really want to see. If you're a baseball fan and you live somewhere, you may want to tune in. So there'll be a place for it. I think there's a lot of future to it. I know they're committed to it for the long term. Also for them, you got to remember, it's a paradox. You're making all this money, and they've been very successful historically. The typical and very successful historically model, successful model for ESPN was you had cable channels. And I don't know if this is true overseas, but it's certainly in America, where as a consumer, you bought a group of channels. So my wife, if she had her own druthers, she would never subscribe to ESPN. She doesn't care about sports. But if she had cable, she would have to get it as part of a bundle of movies and news shows and so on. Historically, now with the proliferation of OTT channels and other cable channels, that has begun to fray, and you have people, cutting the cord and getting highlights. And obviously, with the internet, you can see almost everything. The one thing you can't see, and which is the foundation of ESPN, is live sporting events. So ESPN Plus is kind of a hybrid where they have live events that are maybe smaller in scope, but certain people will really want them. And then you also have the high-end, more sophisticated, if I may say so, of ESPN 30 for 30s or Enhanced. Again, a value equation where they think people will pay what seems like a reasonable amount of $5 a month. I just think ESPN has the challenge of as a brand, they're known as a basic cable channel. Now you think of them as something you have to pay for. I think time will only tell whether they can compete with themselves successfully, because it's essentially what they are. You have two different business models. One is the subscription model on cable. The other is the pay per month, the Netflix model. And, you know, at Netflix at $9 a month, is ESPN Plus worth half of that? I think that's still to be determined.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Yeah, no, it sure is. I guess it's all in a state of flux and will be probably forever more given the rate of change in technology. Let's talk about your episodes then. So we might start with Endurance, which was episode 5, and this looks at the limits of endurance. I mean, this is kind of one of the great human traits that we try and find the limits of everything, really, and endurance is absolutely one of those areas. I mean, part of it, or a good section of it, is focused on the... Well, I suppose, look, the two-hour marathon has certainly become kind of enshrined in the way that the four-minute mile once was. And that's the next great mountain to be conquered. And you talk to various people trying to do that.
Right. Well, the two-hour marathon, and, you know, when I first heard about it, about a year ago when we started this, I thought, well, they're at 2 hours and 3 minutes. It's come down quite a bit in the last 50 years. This sounds pretty easy.
Yeah.
Like, all you have to do is go 1 or 2 seconds faster. The other thing is, if you look at the half marathon, people are running half marathons in under an hour. So I thought, how hard can this be? You know, this record's going to fall pretty quickly. It certainly seemed that way. And the gentleman we focused on, who's on this holy quest, or this driven, almost maniacal quest, a gentleman out of a Greek scientist working out of the UK, very, very controversial and somewhat of an esoteric character. He is sort of confident, but my personal opinion, having now researched it, is those 3 minutes are a long ways away, that we are getting into that zone where there will be continually progress. The drink this guy developed might be a key to that, but it's going to be incremental. This two-hour marathon, it could be 20 to 30 or 40 years before that's broken.
Yeah.
Really.
Interestingly,
as much as we think, oh, what's 3 minutes over 2 hours? Sounds like nothing. It's a lot.
Yeah, no, I had the same misconception, I think, to be honest. You just felt it was around the corner, because I remember and you covered in the piece, the Nike stroke, you know, PR stunt stroke, genuine effort to see how close they could get to 2 hours, where there were conditions which, you know, break all sorts of regulations to try and do it. And they knew it wouldn't be an authentic record, but they got to, 2 minutes or 2 hours and kind of 20, 30 seconds was about where they came in. So
there was a little bit closer to 2 minutes than 2 hours and 1 minute, and that was with all those artificial barriers.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of my inspirations, and we allude to it at the very, very beginning of the piece in passing, was the story of Ernest Shackleton, the adventurer who got lost in the South Pole. I mean, this guy walked across the South Pole, then got in an open boat, rode 1,000 miles in the open ocean, then climbed over for 2 days in waist-deep snow to get to help and didn't lose a single man. So what the real limits of human endurance are is still a mystery. Nobody quite knows. The thing about the brain, and this we allude to in the piece, which I found very, very fascinating, is your brain limits you in ways that protect you. In other words, if you didn't have a governor on your brain and you were a caveman or the primitive man on the plains of Africa, and you're chasing an animal, you know, you would run until you died. So I'm sure some people did. And genetically, people who the brain said, well, let me hold something in reserve. So when you think you're done, you're not done. And that's the question of pushing into that zone, whether it's chemically, psychologically, training-wise, where the limit are, it is really a fungible thing, which is what's fascinating. So
yeah.
Truth is, nobody really knows.
No, it's true. And that drink you mentioned, that Yanis Pistoladidis, excuse my terrible pronunciation of his name, is developing. I mean, it's perfectly legal, but he was making the point that drinks like Lucozade over here or Gatorade over where you are in that part of the world, they might have kind of 5, 6, 7, 8% carbohydrate in them. His drink has 30% carbohydrate. And the trick is to get that carbohydrate into people without them getting sick or having diarrhea, which is what tends to happen. So he's on that quest. Your other episode...
Right, what he's working on is when carbohydrates or sugar comes in your body, it goes in your stomach first, then your intestine. It's not fuel until it's your intestine. So what he's doing is tricking your stomach by encapsulating the sugar in an emulsifier of some kind. Your stomach doesn't get an alarm. It gets into your intestines, and therefore, theoretically, you have, you know, fuel to go further and faster.
Yeah. Your other episode is Mind Gurus, and this really is the next frontier, isn't it, in so many respects? And it is the power of the mind, the extent to which we underutilize it. You come across some amazing people, not least Dutch extreme athlete Wim Hof, who's an extraordinary fellow altogether. So Mind Gurus, I mean, this is such a big tapestry to try and even begin to attack.
Yeah, it was really, you know, we worked with the Gibney people, and again, Alex and his crew, a guy named Brad Herbert is a key, there. I should mention his name because he did such an amazing job. We found three very different stories to try to talk about how the brain is a tool that hasn't been maximized. And Wim Hof certainly is the most fascinating in some regards. And for your listeners who don't know,
yeah,
he has kind of conquered cold, as odd as that sounds. And he you know, has immersed himself in cold. He had a traumatic experience. His wife threw herself out of a six-story building during the running of the Bulls, where his family was living there in Pamplona. And then he went on this sort of walkabout quest using cold as his means to access greater power. And look, you're probably sitting in a very comfortable room right now, right? It's air-conditioned. You know, you're relaxed. With technology, what we've done, I'm sitting in an air-conditioned car here in California. We seek this comfort zone. And what he says is, by putting ourselves from one comfort zone to your car, to your house, to a movie theater, you're always staying in this comfortable area. And we're losing our ability of the body to react to nature. I mean, going back to the story of Shackleton. I mean, imagine walking through waist-deep snow in wool clothes. It's incomprehensible. But they had exposed themselves, the brain adapted. And it's the same thing what Wim Hof has done, is exposing himself to cold. And he's saying that stimulates this primal caveman power that we all possess. And that's the other thing that turned interesting. We found a journalist who wrote a book about Wim, and an article, who was very skeptical. And frankly, because Wim goes around the world like a merry teacher of this stuff, running seminars. And it was like this guy thought, well, this guy's going to kill somebody because he puts people in cold and in ice pools and climbing mountains with their shirts off. But he found that even a guy who was skeptical and not really athletic was able to achieve a lot of the same results. And so maybe there's, and then Wim went under scientific scrutiny, and then they said, is this test, you know, applicable to other people? And the answers came back, yes. So there's clearly something going on there. Exactly what, I don't know. Personally, I did not get in the ice bath. But I do think there's something legitimate.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It would be really interesting to get a feel for what he's advocating, because so much of it just seems to be about breathing and not thinking. These were kind of the things he was shouting out. We saw glimpses of him doing the seminars and fairly normal-looking people putting themselves in fairly cold-looking pools or running up snow-covered mountains topless, and it was all about the breath.
That's what his thing is based on. He's not the only one. There's the famous big wave surfer who's mentioned in the piece named Laird Hamilton.
Yeah.
There's this guy up in San Francisco, I can't recall his name, a scientist who has his own breathing program. But they feel that this sort of deep, deep breathing, meditative breathing, puts you in some state that allows you to access these parts of your brain that you normally can't access. But sometimes it does seem a little bit disingenuous. Wait a second, you're teaching me breathing? I kind of know how to do that. But I think it's a combination of these things. And there are different people working on different ways of using the breath to access parts of your brain you don't use.
Yeah.
There's probably something to it. It certainly works for Wim Hof and people who take his class.
Well, no doubt. And did you get a feel, we're into the realm of speculation, I suppose, but I said it was the next frontier initially. Over the next 10, 15, 20 years, how this is going to be applied in sports? Not Wim, I mean,
well,
generally, just mind gurus generally.
Well, what really actually fascinated me even more than Wim Hof, because he's sort of so singular,
yeah,
was these scientists in Arizona. There's a nerve in your body called the vagus nerve, V-E-G-A-S. Now, science has known about this nerve for a long time. When epileptics in the early part of the century would have a seizure, they found a way to implant an electrical stimulation in your chest that wraps around this nerve, and they would stimulate it, and it would calm you down. Well, the scientists in Arizona have found a way to access this nerve, and the nerve also, it's throughout your whole body, and it's in your lips as well as your neck. So one of the reasons kissing is a pleasurable experience on a body level, it's stimulating this nerve, which calms you down and creates a certain euphoria. Well, they have found a way to use what is essentially earbuds with a mild electronic stimulation that can stimulate this nerve. We took a guy who has PTSD from the Iraq War, and we and with his permission and cooperation, obviously, we stimulated his PTSD, and his heart rate went from 80 beats a minute to 130 beats a minute. Then he put these earbuds in, and in 1 minute, it dropped to 75 beats a minute and stayed there, totally artificially. So what this means for sport is, imagine it's my team Arsenal is playing Chelsea, and I'm an American football fan, and you have a penalty kick, and they try to delay it. They want to use the mind games. Well, you could take a player, come to the sideline, stimulate his vagus nerve, and he would become calm. Right now, that's actually legal. Mm. He could artificially stimulate himself. And there's a drug that's widely used called beta blockers that people with heart problems use to keep their heart rates down. This drug is, I found out in the research, that musicians, particularly when they have auditions, use beta blockers. People who are afraid of public speaking use beta blockers because it keeps your heart rate down. And when your heart rate is down, your motor skills are better. Mm. When your heart rate goes up and when you're nervous, your motor skills become interrupted, and that's why people choke or kick wide or whatever they do.
Yeah.
So this world of accessing the brain scientifically and maybe chemically, which is a little bit scary at the same time.
Mm.
Imagine if all sports you could control your emotions and nobody got nervous and nobody choked. Everybody worked. On one hand, you might have a higher level of performance, but on the other hand, you might lose the human element.
Mm.
So I think there's a very fascinating. And here's sort of the secret behind this, or which he alludes to in my piece, and he wouldn't say very much. All the research is funded by the Department of Defense, because the life of a soldier is actually very similar to what an athlete goes through. You have to perform under pressure. It's like you're a sniper, you're shooting a gun, guys coming at you, you're nervous. They're spending money to develop these things to actually, they use sports as a way to test it, so eventually it will make its way into the armed forces. Kind of scary.
One last very quick question. I suppose more to do with the endurance, but the themes you've touched on there, which your last answer bring it up naturally as well. When you're talking about, the 2-hour marathon, and you're watching, like, you follow this guy Yanis to try and this is like his almost his life ambition. The one thing that I'm sitting there watching this morning, and I'm saying, this is fantastic. Unfortunately, the person that's going to break the 2-hour marathon will have, frankly, questions over doping thrown at him or her. That is kind of where we are. I doubt anyone was volunteering to talk to you about the cutting edge of doping when it comes to endurance, as rife as that probably is.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up. Actually, Yanis is actually very involved, which we could not get to in our piece, with an anti-doping program, because he wants it to be broken clean. The truth of the matter is, in East Africa, where we were, and again, we couldn't get into that within this piece. There's another one of the episodes is more about that, but it's rampant, and you're absolutely correct. I mean, you can go into many pharmacies in East Africa, and there's a back room, and a lot of those athletes are using a EPO, which is a blood enhancer, or a version of that, on a regular basis, and it is an endemic problem. And that could also, in fact, the guy, I can't think of his name, who actually set the current world record, came out of nowhere. Nobody had really heard of him. He set the world record and then has disappeared.
Mm.
So it's very suspicious. Now, I'm not accusing him of anything because I have no knowledge, but there is a big question looming over the and from. In talking to Yanis, who his other business is trying to develop a blood test, it's a big problem, and it's not going away. The dopers are as smarter than the people chasing them.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. Listen, Paul, thanks so much for your time, and the best of luck with the Enhanced series. Again, your episodes are Mind Gurus and Endurance. Thanks a million.
Thank you for calling.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.